Good morning, everyone. This is Fighting Spam and Network Abuse to the Legal System. It's Mr. Wellborn and Mr. Baker that are with us this morning. They'll be talking about the legal aspects of stopping spammers and other network abusers using both criminal and civil penalties, and how some of the anti-spam legislation that we have now is pretty much paper on the wall. So with no further ado, Mr. Wellborn and Mr. Baker.
Thank you. Thunderous round of applause. This is actually going to be fun today. Have any of y'all ever been to this talk here at Dragon Con before? Some of y'all have. It's going to be some new stuff this year. I'm going to tell y'all how to make money off spammers. Just plain and simple, because we got some great new tools. Same rules as always. This is not second grade grammar school. You don't have to raise your hand if you have a question. God forbid I have to sit up here and talk for, an hour or 45 minutes, whatever my time is. I would much rather have a conversation. This is actually, I hate speaking to, huge auditoriums where there's 100 people or 200 people or 300 people, because that inhibits, everybody in the audience. Nobody wants to be the one person out of 300 that asks a question or has a comment. And so that ends up being an hour-long speech, and that's awful for me. I'm sure it's awful for them. It's no fun. This is a perfect size group for us to really just sit here and talk about it. No speech aspect really at all.
Maybe you should lock the door and not let anybody in or out.
Well, if they're spammers, let them in so we have somebody to pick on. So I want to talk about what y'all want to hear about too. Everybody wants to hear about making money, I guess. So I'm sure that part of the speech should be well received in the conversation. But I also want to gear my thoughts and comments to who y'all are. And again, this is a perfect size group. So if y'all would just go right down the rows and tell me who you are, why you're here, we'll do that real quick, and then I'll jump into the few prepared comments I have, and we can get going. Start right over here.
I'm the IT security manager at a very large gambling company, so we have to deal with spam quite a bit. So just want to see how to approach this from the legal end as opposed to the technical end.
Okay, I could negotiate free legal services for online cash.
I'll give you all the lottery tickets you need. They just won't be activated.
Online gambling, well, needle and spamming us.
And what's your name?
John Foster.
Okay.
In about 3 states in the U.S.
Wow. Oh, it's not. So it's legal.
Yeah.
What fun is that?
My name is Kevin Stallard. I'm a senior abuse engineer at Earthlink, and I do a lot of work with Pete as far as making money off of spammers, and come to see if he's holding out on us.
This guy's a whiz, too, y'all, just to brag on my Earthlink people. This is who we go to when we want a right answer and want to get something done correctly. So.
I might blush.
My name is Stephen Critchfield. I'm a programmer / system admin.
I'm Randall Schwartz. I've had some tanglings of my own with the legal system, so I'm interested from that side here and trying to get other people back on that. And last year I gave a talk here about using technological means to limit the amount of spam you got. So,
In 15 seconds or less, what was
it was a combination of attacks, different things, but the one that's actually been the best lately is the high MX trap. It's just been doing wonders.
And exactly what does that do?
What you do is you post two different addresses for receiving mail, mm-hmm. one at a low MX value, which the normal right. people are supposed to deliver to, one at a high MX, which only the spammers deliver to. Right. And then you siphon away all that, and anything that comes from those addresses you block for 2 hours works like a charm.
Here's my idea for the technological means. It would cost a little bit of the ISPs, but it would eliminate spam advertising. Suppose that as a service, every major ISP would, let's say, check to make sure that the link in the email was working before it delivered the spam to you. So what would happen if a spammer sent out, say, a batch of 10 million pieces of spam? 10 million simultaneous accesses to the spam advertised site. It's a legalized DDoS attack.
It'd be almost expensive to do that, though, as it would be for the spammer to receive it. So I don't know what that's really going to be.
Yeah, but yeah,
it's certainly like delay.
It would kill your bandwidth right at first, but it would.
And it's also an attack on other people's sites.
Well, no. It's not an attack. This is
Think of it this way.
It could be a Joe job.
Yeah, a Joe job on someone else.
It'd be fun, but it'd be
lots of our lives are like that.
I'm Wayne Smith. I'm a jack of all trades for a small IT shop in North Carolina, and that's pretty about it.
See, y'all didn't like that one. My other idea, as an ISP, allow your users to refuse all connections and or email from outside the U.S.
We talked about that.
Yeah. That'd stop all the overseas spam and would also stop overseas connections to spam zombies. And as long as you know you don't need to get email from China or
Well, if you could
Taiwan.
Gray-list it by default or something along those lines, mm-hmm. you don't want to be accused of breaking the internet. I mean, that's the problem AOL has. They reduced their complaints by 70%, but they have such a high false positive rate that email is not reliable. So you'd run a risk when you...
Yeah, well, you'd want to set up a non-AOL, non-Earthlink company. We'll call it Homeland ISP.
There you go.
All right, keep going. Did we miss one in the back there, behind Wayne?
She didn't want to introduce you.
You didn't want to do it?
I'm just someone who doesn't like spam.
Good for you. Now, everybody's just telling who they are. I want to make sure. That's all.
Ed Bishop, I'm a software developer, system integrator. I'm currently working on actually a federated identity management solution for some large banks.
Wow.
So,
cool.
You know, security is a big deal for us.
Cool. I'm Wayne Aiken. I'm a programmer and a 419 scam baiter.
You have to order the red breast guy, are you?
No.
Okay.
I'm Pete's wife, Susan. I'm just here to observe.
So she's heard everything I'm going to say today about 1,000 times. Drunken, not drunken, formally, informally.
Formally drunken.
It's more fun when it's informally drunk. That's about it.
Justin Hopkins, and a paralegal in Paleta, Florida. I work for an IP firm.
Okay.
Yeah.
What, nobody from Formula yet?
I'm Laurel. I'm just a user.
Okay.
Just curious.
Who speaks for the users?
My name is Joe Petrosky. I work for a healthcare company in Brentwood, Tennessee. I'm the email administrator. I'm in charge of the anti-spam appliance we use, and so involved in that.
Tina Petrosky. I work for a company that trains all the IT professionals in mainstream crap.
Hi, I just walked in. My name's Tony. I work for MITRE in DC, network engineer.
Okay. Good. Last one.
Dave Nelson. I work for CoxNet.
Excellent. Thank you all for doing that. Like I said, I just like to know who I'm talking to so I can try to. You know, make sure I'm talking about things y'all want to talk about, and I want to go in whatever direction, you know, whatever angle, whatever aspect of all this that y'all want to talk about. So please feel free to interrupt and ask your questions, and we'll just let this be a conversation. One of the things I do want to say is that spam is still illegal. You show me a spammer, and I will show you a criminal. You show me someone who's spamming, I will call him a criminal to his face. I'll call him a criminal and tell him to bring on his defamation attorneys. Spamming is breaking the law. A lot of people are under the misperception that canned spam. Everybody familiar with canned spam, federal law? You know what? It's not as bad as I first thought it was because, you know, we didn't need the cause of action, but it's got some pretty good damages provisions in it.
We've made some good money off canned spam in the past year.
Never before canned spam... Could we, you know, show a case where our damages were $850 million?
can we talk about Mushu? I mean, is that public knowledge yet?
Yeah, I mean, that's just been in all the papers. So
we had a case
that basically we used, we compiled complaints from a guy who's doing Cellar Ringer timeshare spam. And we basically tabulated the number of complaints, and from that, used before, you know, extrapolated the number of emails that he sent. And basically told his attorney, we know you've sent this much email, and under CAN spam, we can file for damages for X amount of dollars. And the attorney basically said, well, we don't believe you have any evidence, and we sat down a stack of CDs in front of him and goes, here are the complaints. And the next words out of his mouth are, when can we settle? it works. And there are a lot of investigations in the hopper where we haven't really taken down any big guys yet, but there are a lot of investigations in the works, and a lot of the small-time guys, it's just not worth it for them to get us any kind of financial judgment against them or going to jail for 18 months. Even as a slap on the wrist, you're talking about guys, the small timers, who are making, you know, their day jobs delivering pizzas. They can't afford 18 months.
As was Moshu's job. And one interesting aspect of that case, and this is public so I can, you know, say this, before we could even respond to the we want to settle, FBI got involved. He threw his computer into the canal or burned it up or did something. Tried to set on fire, I think. In any event, he ended up pleading guilty. And when is sentencing? It's coming up.
October, I think.
Yes, sentences is coming up, but he's going away for a while. You know, just in the past couple of years, Casey Smith, who Earthlink sued, ended up in prison in Kentucky for a couple of years. Howard Carmack up in Buffalo is doing time in New York as we speak. So, you know, it's a great trend that we're seeing of these spammers being put in jail.
Well, we heard, this is one of Lindsay's statistics, but she said something along the lines of, in the past 5 years, we got one judgment, I think it was Carmack, in the past 5 years, but this year alone, we've gotten five judgments.
No, that's not.
Or something, five cases that are coming to resolution or something really ridiculous like that, but we've gotten more results this year than we have in prior years. I think CAN spam has a lot to do with that. A lot of what I do is pulling complaints and, you know, see how much we have on this guy or that guy.
Yeah, well, although, just to keep things in perspective, too, and also to, you know, toot Earthlink's horn, long before CAN spam, Earthlink was winning cases and hammering these guys. You know, before there was a CAN spam, Earthlink hit Howard Carmack for $17 million, hit Casey Smith for $25 million, hit Ronette Goodwin and her gang for $3 or $4 million. You know, all the millions start running together. But it actually serves a great purpose. You know, one of the questions I get asked a lot is, what is the purpose? You know, why go to the extra trouble? Why go to the extra proof? You know, why push it at all if you don't think you're going to get a lot of money of getting the $25 million judgment or the $17 million judgment? And here's the answer to that. It's because you want to send a message to every spammer out there that if you spam and if we catch you, you're going to get the financial death penalty. Whatever you're worth, whatever you make, we're going to get a judgment that's about 100 times that, and we're going to come after you. We're going to take your house and your car. We're going to take your kids' chicken McNuggets. We're going to take whatever we have to satisfy that judgment. And you know, I have a case right now up in Michigan. There's a spammer up there who spammed, was actually very repentant at first and helped out a lot in the Casey Smith case. And so the plaintiff, ISP, in that case, had some mercy on him, and instead of just trying to hold his feet to the fire, took a $118,000 judgment. In light of his great help against Casey Smith, offered to let him settle that for, you know, roughly 10 cents on the dollar. And instead, he didn't get back to, you know, to me for several months, and when we finally, you know, got to the point of saying, look, we're either going to start collecting this judgment, we got to get settled, he offered to pay $10 a month until the $118,000 was resolved. And so I told him to go, any kids here? I told him to go fuck himself.
Yeah. Did he have some sort of longevity cream? So he thought maybe
he might. Yeah, maybe so. And he was going to be hard that whole time too, apparently. You know, he had all the creams, all the herbs. That's right. No, but in any event, so we garnished all of his accounts and whatnot up in Michigan. He didn't have a lot, but we're going to take whatever he has. He filed for bankruptcy protection, Chapter either 7 or 11 Whichever one of those.
From judgment, though, will it?
Well, it saves you from judgments from almost everything, except for if the creditor can show that you incurred that debt due to fraud or an intentional bad faith act. And so, even though if we take everything he has, it probably wouldn't even pay for the bankruptcy legal fees that we're going to incur. You got to send a message to the spammers, we're going to take whatever you have. So, we filed what's called an adversary proceeding, which is like a lawsuit within the bankruptcy to say that, this debt is not dischargeable. We've now forced him into Chapter 13, where he's trying to use the super dischargeability provisions of that case to discharge the debt for, coincidentally, about 10 cents on the dollar, and we're going to fight that tooth and nail. As a matter of fact, we told his attorney last week, this is all happening right now, told his attorney that, either number one, you better know where your guy's money is stashed, or number two, you better be prepared to work for free, because this is going to be a world war. If we have to take it to the Supreme Court, that's fine, but, be prepared to spend the majority of your legal time working for this guy for the next year. You got to send a message to these guys. But anyway, canned spam does not make spam legal. That's a very common misperception. The best way to think about canned spam, of course, says that if the spam has a deceptive subject line, or if the spam has materially misleading header, or if this, or if that, if one of those things is true, then the spam is actionable under canned spam. And so by negative inference, what a lot of spammers say is, well, what that means is that if it doesn't violate canned spam, then it's okay. There is no cause of action. And that could not be more wrong. There's a specific provision in canned spam that says nothing in this law, number one, alleviates or eliminates or it diminishes in any way any other causes of action for trespass or computer fraud and abuse, whatever. And number two, nothing diminishes the ISP's ability to regulate its own private system, which that's what an ISP's computer system is. It's private computers. And so what that all means is that if the ISP says no spam, if it has a publicly posted policy, it's no trespassing sign to the world of no spam, if you send email to that ISP, send spam to or through that ISP, you're breaking the law, plain and simple. It might not be a canned spam violation if you're canned spam compliant, but here's the best way to think about that. Some states have hate crime laws. Y'all might be familiar with those. Hate murder laws that say, if you kill someone or injure someone or whatever, and it was because of or part of a hate crime, then you violate this law. Okay, well, using the spammer's logic, because there's now a law that says hate murder is illegal, then non-hate murder would be fine. That's obviously not the case. And so under the same, it's the same breakdown in reasoning that causes them to say, well, if it's canned spam compliant, it's legal. That's not right.
Well, the other part of that is, under canned spam, for it to be valid under canned spam, you have to be honest in your headers. You can't lie about who the mail's from. You can't lie. You can't try to disguise headers. You can't try to disguise the subject. You have to have opt-out information. There's all kinds of things you have to do with the mail to make it canned spam compliant. That also makes the mail easily filterable. So, if it's, buy my herbal Viagra, it's not going to take an ISP long to figure out, okay, anything with herbal Viagra in the subject, can it? And it's never going to get, so it makes legal spam almost impossible to get through to an ISP that is even remotely competent.
But then again, though, this is like point counterpoint from the old Saturday Night Live, with Jane Curtin and Dan Aykroyd, or Chevy Chase, yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know which one is the ignorant slut here between me and Kevin, but or maybe both of us, who knows. The problem with filters is that they're always going to be false positives. They're always going to be that there's no such thing as a filter that gets 100% of the spam and none of the real mail. For some people, that might not matter. If you don't get, your granddaughter Susie's thank you email for the birthday gift, the world is not, you might make you mad, but the world's not going to come to an end. for some businesses, in some settings, in some circumstances, there are emails that it becomes a bet the company proposition if, because of a false positive, somebody sends it and thinks you got it, and you never did. And so, that, you know, the filters, we shouldn't have to have filters. We should not have to have them. You know, the people that are sending the emails and just get their ass put in prison, you know, or stop, you know, it's like, you know, imagine, I always think of the filters almost as an alarm or an extra set of burglar bars or whatever. You know, people should not be able to continually break into your house and force you to put up extra burglar bars and you know, double thick doors and triple locks, and then complain if you don't do that. Well, okay, it must be okay to come on in and steal.
Just false positives for a second. I'm a tiny ISP, and then I also host a couple of other domains on my machine. And one of the things I do is I run spam assessment in the middle, and I have it set at a fairly high threshold before it even starts putting warnings on things, and really high before it really dies. And it turns out that one of my customers in this small group of 10 people that I support had subscribed to a newsletter, and their newsletter scored like 11.2 on spam assessment. And so, you know, here's an organization that really wants to get mail out there, and yet they write all their stuff in such a way that it looks just like spam. And that's an example of false positives going the wrong way. Now, what we did is we wrote the company and said, you know, here's a few clues about how not to write a newsletter, but you're still going to have problems with that if spam assassins recognizing that all over the world as being spam.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the take that one step further. I was helping John Prades, AOL's, I'm, you know, as you might imagine, the community of anti-spam attorneys is, you know, fairly small and fairly tight, and so there are resources that are shared. I was trying to send a jurisdictional brief about spam that I had written to, you know, another anti-spam attorney, and somewhere between the various ISPs that were involved, first off, I just cut and pasted the pertinent part into the email, sent it. That got, you know, that got lost in space somewhere. So then I thought, well, you know, I guess I'll just go back and I'll you know, cut and paste that into a Word file, you know, attach the Word file, called it, you know, spam brief insert. Whoops. Whoops. I didn't get through. So I thought, fine, I'll change the name of my insert from spam brief insert to you know, contract provisions. Nope. I ended up having to turn the file into a PDF, you know, into a graphic, basically, to get it through. Yeah, you know, which was, and you know, that's all because of the spammers. You know, that goes back to the idea of, you know, all these bells and whistles and locks and bolts, and, you know, they make life more difficult for all of us because we're having to deal with these criminals. Yeah.
My organization, I'm responsible for about 12,000 email users. We use CipherTrust IronMail as our anti-spam appliance, which is a good product. We're happy with it. And we quarantine or keep our email in quarantine that we catch a spam for about a week, and we routinely run 500,000 pieces in a 7-day period. We instruct our users that if they're getting 10% of their daily volume or less of spam, don't even call. That you can expect up to 10% spam. If you're getting more than 10% spam, then you need to call us and let us know. We need to, you know, take care of business with you. We get over a gigabyte a day of JPEGs coming at us, to where we've had to quarantine every email. We're looking at stripping the JPEGs out, but we've quarantined every email coming in with JPEGs. But absolutely, talking about false positives with filters, it's crazy the amount of email that we quarantine accidentally. And as a healthcare company, we've had to go in and look at like Viagra, which a lot of companies don't want. We're a healthcare company. you know, we have to communicate at that level.
If you hyphenate the name, I think that helps. V-I-A. Yeah, that's right.
We've been catching a lot of email as spam with the chemical compound, I don't remember the chemical name, for Valium. And a lot of, when that email comes in, it gets nailed because the generic spam filters that CipherTrust puts in place, 9 out of 10 companies don't want that email. So we spend a lot of our time just releasing quarantined email to where we had to allow users to be able to release their own quarantined email, which has its own little issues. But absolutely, false positives is a huge fight for us.
And you're saying you tell the users not to call, if it's less than 10%. You know, so what you're saying is if the theft against you is less than X amount of time and dollars, then
absolutely,
we're sorry, that's an acceptable level of theft.
Absolutely.
And that is not acceptable. I mean,
and it's literally because of manpower. We do not have the manpower to keep up with all the false positives, and the tighter, just like we're talking about, the tighter you make the net, the more people will get caught that are legitimate. And God help people who do not understand the difference between RFC 821 and 822 headers. It drives me in. I mean, I work with a company I've been working with is Illinois Blue Cross Blue Shield. They cannot grasp the concept at this insurance company when they send out emails securely that their email system actually manipulates the 821 header. And when we get it, the headers don't match, and we don't deliver it. And we've been in a battle for 6 months with them just to correct their email system. You know, I've had to cut and paste them RFC information to try to educate them on what the difference is, because they don't know, and they've implemented their own software. So a lot of times you see companies that will implement software not only to protect themselves, but also, especially in the healthcare industry with HIPAA regulations, to secure data leaving, but they don't understand how to implement it correctly, so you're getting header conflicts. And then companies like ours, which take a detailed look at headers to identify spam, we identify their email as spam.
Maybe you should explain to them, they haven't implemented software, they've implemented malware.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I absolutely understand about a false positive issue. We fight it all the time.
Here's another one we ran into. And I think I told you this one at lunch the other day. AOL has been on their big anti-spam campaign, We Block Spam, et cetera, et cetera. They had an issue down in Indian River, Florida. Some of you guys might have read about this on Slashdot, where the county government of Indian River County, Florida, sent out an advisory to their community, and this is when Charlie and Ivan and all those hurricanes were hitting last year. There's 1,650 some odd email addresses. The email didn't get out because AOL said, "Oh, this is spam," and chopped it, and didn't find out about it later until the county government raised holy hell, like, why didn't any of our people get this advisory? As much as email is being used, ISPs can't afford to be wrong, which is why, from a filtering perspective, like you say, it's a bad idea for ISPs to get into that game.
Yeah, and I mean, to at least play a tiny bit of devil's advocate for AOL, one of the reasons I might have got caught was because a favorite ploy of the spammers, and this was actually, it's not quite as big now, but a couple of years ago, a lot of spam was actually getting out and beating the filters and whatnot because it was sent either as weather advisories or amber alerts.
Every time there's an amber alert.
And a lot of times it would actually correspond to a real weather. You know, somewhere there's a hurricane or a bad thunderstorm. Somewhere some kid is missing. Somewhere there's whatever. And you know, they would have the advertisement at the bottom. This public service announcement brought to you by V1AGR1.
Well, has anybody ever actually done business with any of those companies? Seriously, has anybody ever bought Herbal Cialis or whatever from a company under the facade of a weather advisory or an amber alert? If I were to get that, if I were to get an email that says amber alert, and I open it up and it's Viagra, Herbal Cialis or something, I'm not going to take out my credit card.
Think about that. You don't have to, and literally, 99,999,999 out of 100 million don't have to. If you can get your message out, free. People ask me all the time, and the most common question I get is, why do spammers do it? Does anybody really buy this crap? And you know, the answer is, if you can advertise your product free of charge, you know, especially if you're using, you know, stolen identities to buy fraudulently procured accounts, if you're getting your message out for free, you are ecstatic with a 1 in 10 million or 1 in a million response rate. If you're sending 10 billion or 20 billion email messages a day, you know, right. You're sending that many. A lot of them get caught.
Think of it like this: Super Bowl advertisers are happy reaching between 100 and 200 million people on Super Bowl Sunday. Spammers do that every day.
We're suing a spammer right now that was pumping out. I guess it wasn't quite that much. They were right at a billion a day.
But they're not doing it for free. They're doing it with other people's money.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But to them, it's free. And so to them, they can have a minuscule response rate. If one person out of 10 million, you know, was thinking about his, you know, issues when he opens that and sees the, you know, by the way, try this herbal whatever, then boom, they made their sale.
Is there any kind of stats on conversion rates for these things?
It varies wildly. We've actually done some of that in some of the cases I've had and have seen a response rate of one between 400,000 and 500,000. Carmack made 10 sales with 5 million emails, 6 million emails, something like that. We've seen as high as, I think, 1 in 30,000 reported in cases, but that was for targeted email sends for dental insurance. You know, so, you know, it varies. Yeah.
Two questions.
Yeah.
Programs like Thunderbird use Bayesian filtering.
How good is that? And second question is, I'm thinking about setting up my own server, getting my own domain, just see if I can. And I'm thinking about, well, are there any programs that implement Bayesian filtering for like Linux?
Spam Assassin.
Yeah, I mean, how good is the Bayesian filtering?
That's a better question for one of you techies, probably.
Well, the thing is, using a classical war metaphor, in the race between better armor and better bullets, better bullets always have the initiative.
You know, the nature of defense, by its nature, it's a challenge for offense to overcome. So the better your defenses against spam are, it's just going to force the spammers to get smarter. And they're going to get smarter faster than you can build bigger walls. And that's the nature of the beast. If you play purely defensively, you're going to lose. So the whole rationale behind using legal and criminal penalties to go after spammers is carrying the offense to them and making them go on the defensive, taking the initiative away from them so it no longer becomes profitable for them to spam. Because right now their profit margins are getting thinner every day. You know, people are getting smart to spam. They're not buying the herbal Viagra or the fake Rolexes or the college degrees or whatever. As users get smarter, it's going to become less profitable for spammers to do their business. And if there's more of a more substantial penalty, if they think, wait a minute, I might make $10,000, but I could go to jail for 3 years, it's what we're not trying to stop spam. It's not possible. But if we can send a message that it's not worth it to you to continue spamming, spamming will stop.
Hey, that's a couple of real good points. The phrase I've used for years, I mean, literally since the first person thought of, okay, they're running a subject line filter now, so I'm going to change it from, you know, XXX to you missed our meeting. You know, it's a game of technological one-upsmanship. And, neither side's ever going to completely prevail. I mean, if any of y'all noticed, for the past 3 or 4 years, every year Bill Gates says that he has found the solution to spam, and spam, there'll be no such thing as spam within a year. You know, and we see there's
Microsoft the alpha market.
Yeah, there's you know, still spam.
Other thing, people to deal with your spam.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing is that, you know,
Kevin,
people say, yeah. People say, why even bother? If you can't, if it's a war that's not 100% winnable, where, you know, however many years from now there's zero spams being sent, why fight it? And the answer is that there's no choice but to fight it, because if you take away the companies like Earthlink that have taken the offensive to the spammers and sued the spammers, if you take away some of the, you know, technological buffers that have been put up, if you, you know, let spammers send their emails unfettered, there would be no such thing as email anymore. That would 100% eliminate email as a useful internet application.
See example, Usenet.
Yeah.
Kevin,
yeah.
Get onto this side. We're starting to get feedback now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just speak to Bayesian for one more second.
On this side now.
Bayesian was great when it was a new tool on the block because nobody knew about it. So the spammers were just sending out the same old crap, same old thing. And but once it became a known quantity for them to fight with, then it started becoming less and less effective. It's still effective today if you spend a lot of time training it on precisely the kind of email you get and you get alone. The problem is if you get any kind of email that's outside that, it's likely to be caught as a false positive. So if you have an ordinary style of like exchange mail with just your friends, and you know how they talk and they know how you talk, you can get Bayesian to go, well, this is how we all talk, so this is fine. And that way the spammers' paragraphs that they're quoting out of news stories and using as payload won't trigger it as well. You know, if you can, if you got the time and the patience to do that, Bayesian's still a valid tool. But for most of us, that's beyond the labor cost. There's got to be that we have to use other technological flags.
There's also the issue that spammers. Yeah, I know everybody's surprised I'm talking. Spammers, and this goes back to my mic's on. What Randall was saying earlier about the company that was sending the mail that looked so much like spam to the filters is that the spammers have tools that actually know what's in the default spam assassin configuration and could tell them in advance what the rating's going to be and can make suggestions, synonyms, you know, the dashes, you name it, so that they will now score lower than, you know, your friend sending you mail by accident, you know, sending you that joke they got. So, you know, it does cut both ways. I'd be happy to speak to filtering spam on Usenet, but yeah, we do it fairly effectively. You can't do Bayesian filters there, that's for sure.
Speaking of this topic specifically, I think that's why, and a lot of times the higher-end products are out of the reach of, you know, people trying to set up their own email products or their own email systems, but getting a product that will, you know, use dictionaries in conjunction with Bayesian, in conjunction with, you know, header analysis, to where each only lends a percentage to the entire score versus looking at only one technology is the best bet. But you spend a lot of money for that. They are absolutely expensive.
And you still have a substantial, I mean, not a risk. You have a guarantee of false positives.
Absolutely.
The other side of that is a question of volume. I mean, you say you get how many messages a day?
Tens of thousands of emails a day.
And you know, for an ISP like Earthlink, we're talking about 2 terabytes of email every day. And it's just not possible to process it all. And you have that on one extreme. On the other extreme, you have my grandmother who knows how to work that internet thing.
Yeah.
And you just, here, Grandma, set up this Bayesian filter. Not going to happen.
Can't pronounce it. Something else, there's, while we were talking, I was thinking about, you know, my users, and if any of my users click a link for verbal Viagra, I hope somebody fires them. But, you know, bandwidth consumption, that's an issue with spam. Delaying legitimate email. Storage requirements. You know, when that spam comes in, we've got to store it. We use Notes as our email medium, and a lot of people, you know, whatever. But at least we don't run Outlook as a client. But storage of spam coming in. And retention and discovery, you know, as a corporate entity and having to go back, lawyers saying, go find all this email for this CEO for the last 5 years. They don't want to see the spam. So that delays us in, you know, retention and discovery of email for legal proceedings. It all counts up toward how much money does corporate America have to waste on throwing data storage at spam, on having to go back and do discovery, and on having legitimate email being delayed in process because of spam processing and spam delivery.
Well, it's because corporate America generally is short-sighted. I mean, corporate America would rather spend $1,000 a year on an issue than spend $5,000 a year for the first year to eliminate it forever. And that's just how it is.
True.
All right, let's talk about making some money now. How many people from Georgia in the room?
Woo.
A lot of them. Good, yeah, good, good. The rest of you can just buy a computer and leave it here if you want to. This past spring, a fellow at my firm and I, giving his due credit, Kelly Wallace, two of us wrote what's now called Georgia's Slam Spam Email Act. It was signed by the governor in April, became effective this past July 1st, just a number of weeks ago. It's actually not a spam statute. We actually come up with some cool acronyms like DUCE or some other things for fraudulent unsolicited commercial email. But they wanted to get the spam in there for the sex appeal, for getting publicity for the, you know, administration, which was fine. But it, you know, as a lot of y'all probably know, can spam prohibit states from passing pure spam laws, but says it's okay if it addresses fraud or falsity in the unsolicited commercial email. So that's what this is. It's a deceptive commercial email statute. And the new Georgia law that is now in effect says that any person, that means a person or a company, you know, anybody who initiates, that means sends or causes to be sent. So the person that the spammer and the company that hires the spammer are both liable under this bill, sends a commercial email, and that's defined broadly so that it's any kind of advertisement for goods, services, solicitation for credit application, any of that kind of stuff, that the sender knew or should have known was false or misleading. Yep.
Does that include phishing scams?
Yeah, it would, because they're trying to get your money and get information from you. So, yeah. Anyway, person who initiates a commercial, who initiates the sending of a commercial email, who knew or should have known it was false or misleading, and we'll talk about false or misleading in a second, where the email is sent from, through, or to a protected computer, and that just means a computer that's in the state of Georgia when the email hits it, you know, whether, period. Whoever does that is guilty of initiation of deceptive commercial email, the crime of initiation of deceptive commercial email. Where can you sue? You can sue anywhere that the computer was, anywhere they performed an act or have their money, where the computer was when they sent it or when the email passed through it, or in the county of your principal place of business. So if it's an Atlanta company and it hit the laptop down in Macon, you can still sue in Atlanta, in Fulton County.
Does this mean any Earthlink subscriber?
Well, that's what I'm getting to. Who can sue? Who can sue? Problem with canned spam is you got to be an ISP to sue. And I think that was, you know, DMA lined somebody's pockets for that. You know, their lobbying paid off because, you know, that's heresy. It's ridiculous. You know, the ISPs can't be expected to file every suit against the spammer. You basically have removed anyone but an ISP from the fight against spam via canned spam. So that's one of my main problems with it.
Well,
the
other,
It's defined with reference back to, I think it's back to the definition of it, and it's a term of art, interactive computer service, something like that, as defined in another act. I think it might be the Communications Decency Act, but basically it boils down to whether, you know, as your business, you provide those services.
Since I host these other domains, I wonder if it qualifies me as an ISP.
If you're hosting other ones,
yeah,
you know, maybe.
Money,
yeah, I looked at it as a, for instance, my law firm that provides email service to its users. You know, not an ISP. I mean, to the employees,
right.
Probably not. But the Georgia law applies to any ISP. You know, this is who can sue civilly under the Georgia law. Any ISP or the owner, and this is the one that we very much with purpose put in there, or because, you know, the it was real clear that it had been too much opposition if we said any end user can sue because they were afraid the courts would fill up with lawsuits and all this other stuff. So anyone who owns the domain of the email address to which the spam was sent. So if the spam goes to Pete@wellbornlaw.com, the law firm of Wellborn and Wallace owns wellbornlaw.com, it can sue. And so basically this is a way for anybody to get into the sewer spammer game.
Pete, does RICO touch on this at all, the Racketeer Influence Corrupt Organizations Act, touch at all on the person who's hiring the spammer to send the bulk email, you know, the guy selling the herbal Viagra? Can he be held liable under RICO for violation of canned spam?
RICO is really an entirely different issue. RICO is the Racketeer Influence Corrupt Organizations Act. It was an anti-mafia statute that has now been applied
to everything,
in all kinds of situations that you would never ever think it would otherwise have been applied, including in our spam cases. That's always a cause of action in the spam cases that we file. We argue that the sending of each fraudulent or illegal email was an independent illegal act, that, you know, there was a criminal enterprise going on. That's good because it can give you treble damages, it can get you your attorney's fees, but you don't have to even worry about any of that with this statute. This statute makes it plain and simple and cuts through a lot of the BS that you would otherwise have to prove for some of the causes of action. The Georgia statute entitles you to damages the greater of $5,000 plus your costs and attorney's fees. So the first email, the first spam email that you get that you sue under and find the sender, $5,000 plus your attorney's fees and costs for that first email that you got. but you get the greater of that or your actual damages plus your costs and attorney's fees, or, and this is the fun one, $1,000 per email. Up to $2 million, you know, which would be a heavy hit against pretty much any spammer. You know, the other causes of action in law still apply. And the statute, you know, because canned spam says it can only deal with false or misleading spam, it, of course, applies only to false or misleading spam. And false or misleading is defined very broadly. If the header was obtained by false or fraudulent pretenses, so that covers any kind of open proxy, any kind of use of a spam zombie. If any part of that header is referenced to a computer that you weren't supposed to have, you know, been sending through or been on or been using, then that's header obtained by false or fraudulent pretense.
Is that including the from line? I mean, it picked from address.
That's included later on too. If specifically, if there's a misleading subject line, if there's a manually spoofed header that in any way hides the hampers your ability to find the ID or hides the ID of the sender, if the header fails to identify the actual computer that was used to send the spam, which again, you know, ties in with spam zombie use, if there's a misleading subject line, if it's a Joe job, if there's falsified sender information in the text, and this is another fun one that we, you know, slipped in there, if there's false reference to an alleged opt-in or business relationship. Mm. So any spam you get that's otherwise, you know, legal under canned spam or otherwise 100% kosher, if it says you are receiving this email because you asked to receive such emails from us or one of our channel partners and you didn't, that makes it fraudulent. That pulls it within the ambit of the state statute. And so the spammer can pull his checkbook out for $1,000 an email. You know, or five, if it's just one you got, you know, fine, $5,000.
Is there a defense against that on the spammer's part, though, if they can say, well, we have this website said you signed up for this?
Knew or should have known. If that spammer wants to make that, fine. You know, then you get into an argument of what is the industry norm, what standards should the spammer be held to, was there any kind of authentication at all of the address that was put in, was there an attempt to implement a three-way handshake or a double opt-in process, as is the case with 99% of it anyway, or did they just stick that in there to try to make people think, well, I must have lopped it in and they'll just delete it. So that's Georgia statute. It's found at, starts at 16, the guts of it are found at 16.9.101, and it's about, six or seven sections that all go together. They've got definitions. It's got the guts of it here. It's got pretty stiff criminal penalties, for spamming. But this is a great way for an interested individual to get in the spam game. And, you know, pick and choose your battles. You know, if it's somebody asked about, did anybody ever respond to the spam or buying this stuff? You know, I have received, at my law firm, at our undercover purchasers PO box, Viagra sent from India, blue tablets of God knows what, wrapped in a Kleenex, stuffed in an envelope and sent from India. You know, that's probably not who you want to go after as your individual action here, your cause of action. But you pick and choose your spammers carefully. You go for the low-hanging fruit, and you hit these fuckers. You know, we can make a difference.
Does the Nigerian scam fall under, the context of the Georgia law?
Yeah, it would. It sure would, because that would fall under the broad definition of, they're trying to get money out of you. So, yeah.
Because those are the most interactive ones, because, I use SpamArrest as a service for my email where they send a reply mm-hmm. back to you and you have to put in the numbers on the picture. And always the Nigerian people,
If you can get them to come to Georgia.
or if you can't get them to come to Georgia, I always try to get them to send me money. I tell them I'll be happy to send over our escrow account information, but my law firm has a strict policy. They have to pay a $100 new client fee. And so I've tried that. You know, short of that, if you can't get them to send you money and you can't get them to come to Georgia, at least set up a meeting at a location that has a public webcam.
Check out 419eater.com for those of you who haven't already lived on that site for a while. They have some really good scam baiting tips and things of that help.
Since I'm not an ISP, does replying to the abuse at help at all?
Yes. Can I speak on this one for, this is going to be a minute, so I don't know how you are on time.
No, I'm whatever Daniel needs, but I'm fine time-wise.
The thing about the abuse desk, for example, at Earthlink, we get about 1 million complaints a week, and there is no possible way a human can read all those emails. It's just not possible. So we try to bundle that email and figure out, you know, it's like, okay, we got 50,000 complaints on Herbal Viagra coming from this domain. You use it to find patterns to track down people. This is how we found the timeshare guy. We got 50,000 complaints on sell or rent your timeshare. Well, once we saw that stack of complaints, we go through them and went, wait a minute, they all refer to this address, or they all refer to this site. And then from there, we found Peter Mushu. And from there, we found out he was the guy sending out all this stuff. And it's not any one complaint. It's not like you send it and it goes to an abuse desk and a guy reads your mail and go, oh, he's a spammer. And they use that one email to track the guy down. It's part of a much larger puzzle where your complaint is one of thousands. And when it comes to the point where we're looking at damages, we can say, well, we got 50,000 complaints. And for every complaint, we can assume that it's X number of emails. And some people say it's one complaint per thousand. Some say it's one per hundred. You know, that varies from case to case, but we can say for every complaint we got, that represents X hundred emails that he sent, and from that we can sue for X amount of damages. So it's the difference between a $10 million judgment and a $25 million judgment. Or I don't know how much we're getting out of Mushu. It's not nearly that much. But it's that same kind of, it's like, okay, we got 20,000 complaints on this guy. He's relatively small time. Or we got 100,000 complaints. This guy is huge. We need to take him down. And it helps us prioritize who the bigger problems are and who we need to go after first. The more complaints we get, the more data we get, the easier it is for us to see who we need to go after.
Just to jump in here real quick, guys, I work an abuse desk in a different form for Usenet. It will vary, you know, depending on if you have Earthlink. You know, I've used Earthlink myself, and I felt well covered there. But different companies deal with abuse desks differently. So it's probably better to send it than to not send it, but, you know, it's a time issue. You know, if you have the time to do it, do it. If filtering seems to be a better use of your time, do that. If you can automate your stuff and you feel confident that you're not wasting their time, do that, you know, to report. But, you know, we get very low volume of complaints because we do Usenet. We're very good at filtering what our users get out. I don't have to worry too much about the abuse desk while I'm here, you know, and go back and there'll be a few things. But if something is really a problem for you, try it. You know, it definitely can't hurt, and it can, you know, depending on the ISP, it could give them something more to go on that can help in the long run. You know, if you take a longer view, it may not stop that mail from coming to you. Even if Earthlink cuts them off, then they just may move on until Earthlink comes and squashes them out later, which is the effectiveness of lawsuits over filtering and over just reporting them.
I've got a question. Does anybody pay attention to spam cop reports? Yeah, SpamCop is a very nice automated way of looking up the ISPs and an automated way of sending out abuse reports. But just the other day, it literally clicked over 1.5 billion complaints, and the spam just keeps increasing. I'm just wondering if any ISPs really pay attention to it anymore.
Here's the problem. It's not that we don't have enough information. It's that we have too much. As bad as the spam problem is, the flood of information that comes into an abuse desk. You know, my job, I don't go through complaints. As a senior abuse engineer, basically my job is to write the tools and the scripts for the abuse investigators to do their job. And my tasking is to take this kind of information, make sense out of it, put it together with all the other information we get so that we can prioritize what our investigators do. Or we can prioritize the cases that we send to Pete. And we joked many times that we're going to put a drive-in window at Pete's office. You know, because if my job is complete, then it's going to be the point where we can pull up a screen and say, here are our top 20 spammers today. Gather, you know, get the evidence we know we're going to need, send it off to Pete and let him do his thing.
I will tell you what you can do to make Kevin's job easier too, or his counterpart at any ISP or any organization at all that gets complaints. Number one, if there is an automated way to send the complaint, if there is a "this is spam" button, use that as opposed to, you know, forwarding it or cutting and pasting or whatever, because that automated response system is going to be set up in such a way that it maximizes, you know, the ability of the computer rather than a person's time to analyze it. So that's going to help, or at least get it in the right spot. Number two, if you do send it on or forward it or feel compelled to send your own email to abuse at filling the ISP name, make sure you get the headers from the spam, all the information, and send one spam per complaint. And ideally have that, you know, that and only that, you know, there doesn't need to be an explanation from your user of, I've received this email 9 times, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And number three, and one of the most important, don't send, you know, 15 different spams all cut and pasted into the same complaint email. That's almost worthless. So,
I was going to take it for granted that a human's not going to read it.
Yeah.
I mean, just take it for granted. Like I said, we get 1 million a week. It's going to go through an automated system, and it's going to wind up in a queue. And it's important information, but, you know, you type in your dissertation about why spam sucks, we don't care.
Yeah.
We know.
Nobody's going to read it unless they happen to go looking for spam from that particular spammer. I mean, as a rough generalization.
Exactly.
And to circle back about SpamCop, it often includes extraneous information that the abuse desk is going to know that it would take. If you're sending it to somebody who can't look at those headers themselves and say, yeah, this definitely came from us, you know, as it goes through, it tends to give a lot more information than is really needed. The website, having to go to a website to look up the information or to see why it thought that, you know, we sent, you know, we do Usenet, why we sent this email, which was erroneously tracked back to us, you know, why it thought it was us, you know, it can waste time in some cases, but it at least does give the full headers, and it doesn't go on too much. It goes on in ways that we know and we can go ahead and skip over.
And I'll tell you another way it helps too, and this is not quite as true now, that the spammers that you see now, one of the great things that's happened with the awareness of spam that's happened over the past few years with some of the laws that have been passed, with the lawsuits, and especially with the technological buffers and filters and tools, is that, you know, more so than ever, to be a spammer, you have to be a criminal. I mean, spammers are forced by all these measures to turn to increasingly illegal ways to get their spam out. Gone are the days of Sanford Wallace and Cyber Promotions, when he could sign up for the resources in his own name, send the spam from his own computers, everything, you know, honestly tracked back to him, and you still had some kind of dispute or whatnot. So, you know, more so than ever, you show me a spammer, and, you know, I'll show you a criminal. So,
what do you think about the Russian solution?
Oh. Well, if that had been a solution, it would have been great. But from everything I've read, he thought he had picked up 2 good-looking girls at a bar when they got back to his apartment. Let me back up. What he's talking about, I assume, is a well-known Russian spammer was found with his head beaten in, you know, dead. About a month or so ago, and at first, because he's so notorious a spammer, everyone assumed it was spam related, you know, which would have been a great start. But
I have pleaded 5th Amendment.
I'm sorry. No, but as it turned out, there was, you know, one criminal was the victim of other criminals, you know, just coincidentally. It was a scam where 2 girls would hit on him in a bar, or hit on, you know, whoever in a bar, go back to the guy's place, they would slip something in his drink, and after he passed out, they'd rob him blind. And so he woke up when they and their accomplice were robbing him blind, and so they beat him to death. So, but, I hate spammers worse than anybody. If you think you hate spam, try dealing with spammers and their attorneys. You want to talk about the lying, cheat, and scum of the earth? You know, I almost hate spammers' attorneys worse than I hate spammers. And, you know, so it's, you know, if they're courteous and professional to me, I'm the same way back. But almost by definition, I think if you represent sleaze like that, you must turn into sleaze like that. And so, you know, my rule lasts about, 2 weeks until I know they're lying, cheating, you know, breaking every ethics rule there is. And after that, I just let them know the gloves come off, you know, and if I have my way, I'll see you out begging for food with your law license lost and your client in the poorhouse. So,
as a someone who hosts, like, emails like Hotmail or AOL, anything, if someone's sending, like, a billion emails a day, couldn't you just outright block them before you even get a complaint? Is that even legal?
We face that every day. Part of our job, and I'm trying not to get too far into telling tales, but for instance, if there's somebody who fraudulently signs up for an Earthlink account and starts broadcasting spam, it happens. We canceled 40,000 accounts this year, but people who have signed up using fraudulent information to send out email from Earthlink's mail servers. Invariably, they find their way to AOL because there's a large user base there. You know, use dictionary AOL accounts, and you'll hit a limit really fast. And AOL will say, okay, Earthlink, you're cut off for 48 hours or 24 hours or 72 hours or whatever until you find this guy who's spamming us and take care of him. And that's a not quite daily, but a frequent thing is somebody will come in and sign up for an account and they start sending email, and then it's like we got an AOL block. Call everybody in, find a fraudulent account, cancel it, call AOL, get on the horn with them, say, hey, look, we found the guy. He's gone now. Unblock us. Happens far too often, and it happens among far too many ISPs. So they say, we don't want to deal with your spam. It's coming from a known ISP. We're just going to cut you off. And that basically breaks the internet. You know what I mean? It's the whole point that the internet is connectivity, and when you're getting enough garbage from one source, somebody's going to cut you off. And whether it's AOL and Earthlink, or whether it's, you know, your local domain and your upstream ISP, you know, if somebody's got a bot on your network and starts broadcasting spam, the obvious solution is to cut you off until they find where the problem is. And that's part of the expense of spam. That's part of why spam is bad, is because rather than deal with it, they're just going to cut you off and say, don't talk to us. And that defeats the whole purpose of why we're in this business.
Last thing, on a more personal account, there was this obviously really illegal email. It had stolen one of my friend's like full name and said, your friend's full name here just sent you this email. And his normal titles are like sup bitch, so it obviously wasn't from him. Can you do more against the really obviously illegal emails?
It's without knowing the full circumstances of this particular email, I can say there's a lot of malware and there's a lot of things out there in this world that can take things off your hard drive that you don't even know you have. And they can, you know, if they can do that, it's almost trivial to mail that to somebody else. And whether, you know, a lot of these worms will go through your address book and, you know, okay, here's this guy's personal information. Now we're going to send it to everybody in his address book. That's a different problem for a different day.
Or send spam and spoof it as being from random addresses in your address book. I had the hardest time explaining to my dad why the fact that he was getting bounce backs did not mean his computer had a virus.
I love the amount of bounce back I get every day that says that my OpenBSD box has been infected by a virus.
Yeah.
All right, well, another one you see, and you'll see this in large corporations, is Windows security patch, new virus found. And you have this attachment that, for all intents and purposes, looks like a zip file, you know, virusupdate.zip. What you don't see is it's virusupdate.zip, 80 spaces, .exe. So when you click on the attachment, boom, there you go. You're infected. And, you know, it's a dirty – a lot of the times, you know, spammers can set up bots because they'll send what looks like an innocent-looking attachment. Some guy goes, oh, well, this is an antivirus update. Click.
And I can tell you, too, that the people would shit if they knew the breadth of the problem of compromised computers. And I'm talking about even computers that are running one of the, you know, semi-worthless, off-the-shelf, everybody-uses-it type firewall or, you know, that type of software. We've got a spam investigator right now who is working on infiltrating spam zombie networks. And on just one of these networks, this guy's just a whiz. But he's been able to, he does complete packet analysis of everything going both ways, just a whiz. He was able to get onto one of the spam, the network administrators' lists of, then current in the network, ready to be used, spam zombie IP addresses, 70,000. 70,000, and that's just who happened to be logged on, the infected machines that just happened to be logged on at that moment. So probably multiply that by, three, four, five, six. So you're talking millions of computers out there, probably tens of millions if you include all the different crime rings and all the different, substantial spam zombie networks, millions of users that are compromised and don't even know it. That's scary.
I've seen figures of between 5 and 20 million estimated of the zombies currently now based on the number of IP addresses that are sending out zombie-like mail. So
yeah. Well, but what's even scarier, too, is that those might be low because our guy had, checking all the lists and all the supposedly comprehensive files of networks that he knew he was logged in on and knew he was a part of, and they were only catching like 30%. If he had 10 addresses on, only 3 of them would actually be propagated to that list at any given time. So you may even multiply it by more than that if you're going just by the total number of IP addresses in those lists. So yeah, that's a big problem. I mean, and the good news about that is, if you cut off the head of that beast, you can do some serious damage. This is not going to be taken out, the spammer who was sending 500,000 emails a day. You could see a serious hit and really see some substantial improvement if you start hitting some of the big fishes, because it goes back to what I was saying earlier. The little guys are the little guys, and especially the non-criminals, put that in quotes, are being driven out of the spam business. So what you see are fewer spammers who are sending emails, because of their size and because as the technology improves, sending more emails on an exponential scale. So that's the good news in the fight, is that you can see a difference just by taking out a few people.
Well, it's creating barriers to entry. You're not going to see a lot of new folks go, I think I'm going to get into the spam business. Your stupid spammers get caught way too early, way too quickly. What the next step is probably going to have to be is we're going to have to take down some of the larger fish and tell folks lower down on the food chain, you're not safe. And when that message gets out, don't mess with this ISP or watch out for this network. When those messages start getting out and start getting effective, you'll see a drop. I don't know that it'll ever completely go away, but if you can make it cost prohibitive for somebody to do business in this manner, they will eventually stop doing business in that manner.
Or if you put them in jail.
Either way.
Dane, do you want to talk a little now?
I guess I can just speak from a different perspective here, where I wish that we had more of a legal recourse for what we see. My name is Daniel Baker. Bent for about a decade now, I've been the chief Usenet administrator for supernews.com. When I first came on board, we were a spam problem. The people there, it's two guys in a garage, had no clue. They had no idea what they were doing. And there weren't any tools out there for this at that time either. Those of you who may be familiar with CleanFeed, that wasn't out there. So there was no standard Usenet filtering option for a server to use to keep their users in line. But we wrote our own. I got us off, a whole lot of people's shit lists there. It's a lot of sites had been blocking us, because just like with AOL and Earthlink, on Usenet you get the Usenet death penalty. Other sites can just block you by your path or block everything, and they don't transfer your stuff either. So it, all in all, it really breaks down your effectiveness as a Usenet site if people aren't taking your traffic and aren't passing it. So I got us out of that bind there. Now Jeremy Nixon of CleanFeed works for us. He doesn't get to work on the filters anymore, because that's still my baby. But we don't have really any legal recourse. We have to work with the best technological approaches that we can get. And we're considered good, even though there are still news groups that you can go to on our server where it is, it's still a cesspool more or less, and that's, before you get to the content,
Why do you say y'all have no legal recourses?
I don't think that any of the laws really apply to us because it's Usenet, it's not email.
If it's on your servers and if it's your system, you can make whatever rules you want. And
so still, we could go with the legal trespass.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you could say that it's a violation if the user posts in green ink. Green type.
Yeah, we've also got issues where if you post to Usenet, you're not sending it to our server, say from another server. You're not saying, this is going to go to people at SuperNews. So it's a broadcast thing. I don't know if that would alter it for most of the spam that we see these days is from elsewhere. Most of the spammers, they just don't last long on us. The only reason they stick around is because we don't tell them that we're not sending anything.
Right.
We just eat it. And that's the only reason they stick around. They don't tend to come back because it's a very frustrating experience. And we like that.
And I'll say one last thing, and then I'll set my say. If you have a system, you can make your own rules, make people agree to those rules if they're going to use your system, and sue the crap out of them if they violate those rules. And that's regardless of anything that's in any other law in the country. Period. 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 Period.
Actually, to turn things back to you, because I think that most people here probably came here for email spam. I know Randall mentioned Usenet and the wretched cesspool that it's become of spam there and what you can do. He implied it. But for all those bounce messages that people get, is there any sort of recourse? Is there any sort of recourse there? I know I run my own mail server. I have plenty of domains, and apparently I send out a lot more spam than I really think that I would be due to all the spam, the bounces that I'm getting. But I'm only getting the bounces. No mail is transiting my servers, and I'm not necessarily getting the spam myself I'm never seeing it. But I'm getting tons of bounces. It is impacting, server performance.
Yeah, there are still causes of action. You can try to assert all the regular spam causes. You also would have a tortious interference with contract. You'd have some Lanham Act or mark type, trademark type claims, depending on what the domain is. You still have a trespass because they know they're going to be bounce backs, and so it's just as much trespass. It would be just as much trespass for me to send straight to you as me to send to someone else and know it's going to get bounced back. So there's still trespass. So, if it's spoofing. Spoofing was actually adjudged clearly illegal even sooner than spamming was, going all the way back to the flowers.com case. The courts at least kind of thought about, whether spam was legal or not early on. That's the spoofing, and it's clearly illegal. Not even an argument to be made, ignorant argument that the spammers make, at least their arguments. So, there's always legal cause of action for this kind of stuff, always.
And what about under the new Georgia law? Being here in Georgia myself, that one sounds like something I can participate more in. If I got bounce backs to my server, which runs here.
It's definitely an advertisement. I think that would certainly be covered by the Georgia law because it would be an advertisement. And I can look back at the exact language to ensure, but it's definitely an advertisement, and it's definitely getting to you, and it has a falsified header. Indeed, the falsified header and information is why you got it. So, heck yeah.
Good. Good to know. Does anybody have any questions about Usenet or spam on that? Then I'll...
Any more questions in general, for that matter?
Have you killed Cantor and Siegel yet?
They're buried in our backyard. Don't tell anybody that.
Okay.
Why are the laws different for email spam rather than in your mailbox physically spam?
Couple things. First off, I don't know the statutory side, but your mailbox is part of the federal postal system. So, unlike you actually own your computer more than you own your mailbox. As a practical matter, and this is the real answer, imagine what your front yard would look like if every company could print and send thick catalogs advertising their stuff for free. If every company can print it for free and send it for free, then you would not be able to get to your house because there would be tons and tons and tons of catalogs, which is actually what they did to Alan Ralsky. I would never suggest conduct like this. Spammers, Alan Rowski.
Describe it in detail, though, so we know how to...
Notorious spammer, Alan Rowski, up in Michigan. Some anti-spammers apparently subscribed him to every free snail mail catalog company there was, you know, 10 different times, every permutation possible, every company possible, and he was getting literally tons of catalogs per week.
Now, I've heard, I can't verify this, but I've heard that you can write directly to the Direct Marketers Association and ask to be put on mailing lists for catalogs because there are people who love to receive that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's true.
You got wood burning stove.
Just trying to supply him with some fuel.
So,
that's great.
Anyway, what was your question again? I want to make sure I finished answering the whole thing.
Why,
difference between, okay, so that's the practical answer. We would never be having this panel, never be having this conversation, never have this issue talking about snail mail because there is a cost necessarily associated with sending that email. Suppose, for instance, that, different internet, different, universe, whatever, that it, no matter what, no matter who you were, it cost a penny per email to send it, period. Or a nickel per email, or a dime per email, or 30, what is it now?
30, yeah.
30 whatever cents to send, suppose it costs 30-something cents to send an email. Then there'd be no such thing as spam, really. You would get no more spam than you got paper junk email. And so that's the answer. That's why. It's because the lure of spam is that you can send it free, and there's no possibility of doing that with print copy sent via snail mail.
Actually, spam is kind of like snail mail sent postage to you.
The complaints that we file.
You're paying
this
to read
is a
it.
Language that, mm-hmm. that it's been in there since the first such suit that we filed back in 96 or 97. Mm-hmm. But the spam is like a COD package that you are forced to accept and pay for, or a collect call that you have no means to decline.
Well, it's like cell phone spam,
You're paying for it.
Call, yeah. They have laws against that.
As they do with junk faxes for the same reason. So.
Well, that got weakened recently, didn't it? Something
changed the junk fax law.
Did it?
6 months, yeah. So it's got less tooth or something. I forget what it is, though.
I'll have to go back and look because I have tried to stay up to date. I know that there was I think one court said there was no class action. Under the TCPA, Telephone Consumer Protection Act. Again, if you want to screw with some people and make some money, every junk fax you get is $1,000. And this is the part that a lot of people don't know. If you get those telemarketing calls that you say hello and it's a recording, if you get that at your house, that's illegal. So you can act like you're interested, find out who it's from, and then sue the crap out of them wherever you live. So.
There's some companies now that will actually do that for you. It's a place that I use a product called Fax Recovery Systems. You just send it to them, and you assign the rights to it over to them, and you'll get, if they can successfully prosecute the junk fax, they'll give you $50 back for it.
But $50, that means they're operating on exactly. On 95%. Yeah, but you still you send it to them, either they throw it away or they prosecute it. That's 95% contingency. That's got to be illegal. You would think.
Yeah.
If not, I'm gonna have to renegotiate with Earthlink. All right. Any more questions? Anybody?
With other jurisdictions, say Russia and China, to update their laws to be somewhat in accordance with ours?
Ideally, if this were utopia, there would be. And I'm being serious. If this were utopia, we would have a worldwide conference on spam, something like ICANN with teeth. That would pass. Universally good laws that all the countries would adhere to, would enforce, would pass. Instead, it's like the Wild Wild West out there. Some countries are setting themselves up as spam harborers or internet, you know, I mean, in kind of the same way that the Antigua and some of those set themselves up as the home for the offshore, you know, yeah, offshore banks and offshore offshore casinos. But, you know, instead what you're going to have to see is more international legal enforcement, more means of giving a user the ability to just decline foreign emails, and more cooperation between, and hopefully we're seeing some of this right now in some cases I'm working on, cooperation between international law enforcement bodies. Sending spam from, say, Russia to the U.S., is, you know, people say, oh, how can you, you know, there's no way you can, you know, legislate what he can do in Russia, there's no jurisdiction. That's crap. If, you know, if somebody in Russia is setting off missiles at the U.S. and it blow up your building, certainly you have a cause of action against that person. They can't say, well, he's in Russia, so you can do nothing. And, you know, each piece of spam is a figurative missile. So, you know, jurisdiction's definitely there.
The other thing you need to look at is if you go on to Spam House or any of those websites and you look at the list of top spammers, the Roxo list, the huge majority are right here in the United States. And we need to clean up our own backyard first before we start getting on to Russia and Germany and Japan and Korea about their problems.
And a lot of those, even the ones, you know, a favorite trick of spammers, you know, the spam appears to have come from China. And it appears that the website is hosted in China, et cetera, et cetera. But by golly, when you go ahead and buy what's on there and start the discovery and track it back, it, you know, they're based in, you know, Arizona or California. So, you know, a lot of spammers that, you know, make you want to make you think that they're overseas spammers. Not really. Just one more trick.
Can you combine the Georgia law you were talking about with Randall's trick of a high MX record? So most spams go to the machine in Georgia and then prosecute from that.
Of course, it's not a I'd say it's not a trick. It's just the fact that you know, you can locate your computers wherever you want to.
Well, specifically on that, the majority of your real email would go to your normal email server, but you're, I guess, misdirecting the spam through a jurisdiction.
You're not misdirecting it. You're using your own mail server to collate.
Okay, that's what I want to make sure of.
Yeah. And like spam is directed. You know? Spam isn't directed.
Follow Randall's example earlier, a higher MX record is more likely to capture that spam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the spam itself was never directed. They didn't mean to catch you outside of Georgia.
Yeah.
They didn't know. They just wanted to get you.
Exactly.
So who's going to set up a company where we can start doing these hostings?
Well, you do. You know who to call as your lawyer. That's, you know.
No, I want a hosting company. I can go put a machine in.
Yeah.
Then I'll come to where I talk to you.
That's right. Then you come to where I talk to you. That's right. All right, y'all. Thanks very much.
All right. It's time to make some money, Pete.